The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this Wednesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, I'll speak with the CEO from one of the four groups being investigated by the Secretary of State's office.
We still haven't been contacted by the Secretary of State or their investigators. And so this is nothing more than a press conference and an attempt to traffic in disinformation and spread Republican fan fiction.
But first, speaking of elections, Georgia counties are working to finish another recount of the general election results by tonight's deadline, just before midnight. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger gave an update earlier today.
We have had about 110 counties that have finished their work. In our continuing conversations with the counties, we anticipate all of them will make our midnight deadline. We'll be putting up the reporting site up at 2 p.m. today. We have seen no substantial changes to the results from any counties so far.
Now, Secretary Raffensperger is also standing by statements made yesterday from Gabriel Sterling. He's a voting implementation manager for the office, and he called for an end to threats of violence against election workers.
This is elections. This is the backbone of democracy, and all of you who have not said a damn word are complicit in this. It's too much. Yes, fight for every legal vote. Go through your due process. We encourage you. Use your First Amendment. That's fine. Death threats, physical threats, intimidation. It's too much.
Sterling said a Gwinnett County voting machine technician was facing death threats after online posts claim he manipulated election data. The worker, a man in his 20s, reportedly found a noose outside the door of his home. It's being reported an accompanying note cited the technician should be, quote, hung for treason, close quote, for his role in the election. In other news, former Atlanta City Councilmember Kwanzaa Hall will finish the remainder of the late Congressman John Lewis's term. Hall's term will be brief. That's because Congresswoman-elect Nakima Williams will take over the seat in January after winning in the November election. And finally, healthcare workers and nursing home residents should be first in line to receive a vaccine once it's available. A panel of health experts convened by the Atlanta-based Centers for Disease Control and Prevention voted 13-1 about this yesterday. Experts say a potential vaccine will probably not become widely available in the U.S. until the spring. Meanwhile, in Georgia, at the time of this broadcast, 424,929 COVID-19 cases have been confirmed here in the state. 35,063 have been hospitalized, and of those, 6,536 are considered ICU admissions. Now, since the state began recording these numbers back in March, 8,798 deaths have been confirmed. And as always, we get our information from the Georgia Department of Public Health. Now, just moments away, I'll speak with Georgia's Department of Labor Commissioner, Mark Butler. This is Closer Look. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. October was a pretty good month for Georgia's workforce. According to the Georgia Department of Labor, October's unemployment rate dropped for all metropolitan areas and counties across Georgia. And according to the department, some of these areas were reporting rates that compare with pre-pandemic unemployment rates. So that's some welcome news considering the record number of unemployment claims and rates this year. And what a year it's been for the Labor Department. Joining me now is Georgia's Labor Commissioner, Mark Butler. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I recall our first conversation regarding the pandemic in your department. That was back, I think, on March 17th. You were optimistic that the state could weather this pandemic storm, but here we are in November. So, Commissioner, how would you assess what you all have been able to do in terms of providing not just unemployment benefit claims, but in general, the services for those seeking, you know, employment? How do you sum up from March to now?
Well, it's been a tremendous challenge that I don't think that most people can kind of grasp of what my employees have had to deal with. You go back and look at what was passed in the CARES Act. Mm-hmm. Basically, when you're talking about financial relief, 90% of the responsibility of all the different programs were actually put on Department of Labor's around the nation. And a lot of the things we've been asked to do are things that did not exist before March. They're brand new, extremely complicated programs. It's been a tremendous challenge for us to have to kind of deal with, but they have met that challenge, and it's not been without, you know, a lot of sacrifices. You know, a lot of my employees were used to working maybe, you know, five days a week, and they've been on a 7-day a week schedule since March. A lot of them are working 10 to 12 hours a day. And the reason for that is, you know, like a lot of companies during the pandemic, hiring has been a massive challenge. And even though we have added personnel and also a lot of temp workers, it has been a tremendous challenge to do that. And so, you know, a lot of sacrifices made, and there's been a lot of, we've had a lot of, you know, a lot of sickness also in the department, especially here lately. For some reason, we've had a tremendous increase in individuals getting COVID in the department. And so we've had to take some additional steps on that. And we've even had some people pass away due to complications from COVID that work here and other health issues. So, you know, we've had a tremendous amount of challenges, and a lot of people see a lot of the press reports, you know, criticizing us, but quite frankly, I think there needs to be more people taking a look at it instead of trying to be sensational and, you know, give the department some credit, because, you know, you're talking about some real heroes that have been working here that have laid it on the line, because I don't think anybody can really understand the workload and the amount of things that have been accomplished and done during this time.
Well, our condolences on the loss of your employees, Commissioner. That is very tragic to hear, which leads me to this, because back in March, we talked about what your department needed in terms of resources, not just for providing your services, but for your own employees. How is that now? Have y'all been able to get them everything that they need to do their jobs?
Really, what ended up happening was we basically had to kind of look inside ourselves to find our immediate help. When we talk about the total number of employees at Department of Labor, which is roughly around 1,000 individuals, the vast majority of those people actually do not work in the unemployment department. Mm-hmm. You know, we do a lot of other things here. And also you got support personnel and things like that. When you talk about pure unemployment employees, you are really only talking about, you know, a little over 300 individuals. And so we've been able to more than double that amount just by moving individuals from, you know, different grants or different departments, and also bringing back, at least for a while, a lot of recent retirees. When I say recent, I mean in the last 3 years, because anybody that's, you know, has retired from us beyond 3 years, they, you know, they're going to be starting from scratch when it comes to the systems we're using because of all the changes that we've made in the last, you know, 2 to 3 years. We were able to easily double the UI staff in a short amount of time, but we've also reached out and worked with a lot of temp agencies to help us fill in some of the gaps in some of the support areas and research areas. But still, you know, your biggest issue is, you know, a lot of the heavy workload is going to come down to dealing with some of the more complicated cases or a lot of the appeals cases, adjudication, which takes somebody with a fair amount of experience, in a lot of cases, years of experience, and you can't hire that, unfortunately. It's not like you can go hire from other states because other states are experiencing the same issues we are, which also lends to some of the other problems that we've had when it comes to increasing our IT staff, because a lot of things that we've been doing have really put a lot of pressure on our IT department. And so we basically have been competing against the other states around us to attract additional talent, which we've more than doubled that staff also during the same amount of time. So, you know, it hasn't been easy. It's been extremely difficult, but I'm proud of the work that we've done. Has it been perfect? No, but I don't think anybody should expect it to be perfect when you're talking about the constraints and also the pressure and the massive amount of workload that we've been dealing with.
Commissioner, any idea, can you put a number on how much Georgia has paid out in unemployment benefits, let's say since March and April, as y'all started processing these claims?
Oh, yes. It's been well over $15 billion. Basically, you could add up the last 27, 28 years and not get to that number. And you've done that in a very short amount of time. I mean, you're talking about basically squeezing, you know, 28 years worth of work into about 6 or 7 months with one of the lowest, when we started, one of the lowest staffing numbers we'd been at. And people said, well, why was your staffing so low? Well, mainly because of an old and outdated federal funding formula. We are, the UI department is actually funded based upon how many claims that you normally see. And Georgia was actually, before the pandemic started, was seeing claims numbers that were at their lowest level they'd been at since like the mid-1970s. And so, I mean, you're talking really low claims number, which actually causes your funding to go down, which means you can't hire additional people and get your numbers up where you would like them to be, which is one of the cases that we made back in January. And our argument was that we need to keep ourselves at a basic floor of staffing in case something bad happened. Matter of fact, that was actually part of my presentation was, if we don't add more people and get more funding, if we have an emergency happen, you know, we're going to be way underfunded. And then 3 months later, that's exactly what happened.
$14 billion. Wow. And I remember back then in March, you did anticipate that you would see some record numbers. But there was something else that we talked about, too, because the career centers have been so important. We've had conversations in these career centers. Are they now back open, Commissioner?
First of all, let's be clear. They have never been closed. That we just not have not allowed public access. Those employees have been working every day. We have not, sent employees home. Like a lot of state governments, they sent employees home and have told them all to work, telework if they can. Some of them have just been kind of temporarily laid off. Here, we did not do that, except for, you know, certain cases where you've got, especially because we do have an older workforce here. Those individuals, a lot of those we did, obviously those need to telework to keep them safe. But those individuals have been showing up in those career centers and trying to answer the phones as best as they can. But when you're talking about, even once we doubled our UI staff to over 600 from the 300 that we had, when you're talking about an average daily call volume of 60,000 calls a day, that's a physical impossibility to be able to get to all those calls. We can't risk losing more people due to COVID.
Well, what changes or adjustments did the department have to implement based on whether there was, quite frankly, complaints or feedback from your own staff? I guess, in other words, what lessons were learned and that now you all have had to shift or alter a particular operation as relates to getting these claims processed or even investigating, you know, people who wanted to appeal if their claim was denied for whatever reason?
Well, we've had to invest in a lot of additional technology. We've also, you know, added a lot of new partners, especially when it comes to fighting fraud. Not only have we, obviously, we're working with a lot more law enforcement agencies that typically we haven't worked with in the past. The biggest challenge has come from the additional and new programs that were passed in the CARES Act. Especially the PUA program, which is unemployment for those that are self-employed gig workers, individuals that had previously not been paying into the system. We had no record of those individuals' income or any kind of information on them, and having to build a system from scratch to be able to fit all the requirements that Congress put in that particular system has been a mega lift. And it's been very difficult. And it's been very interesting, too, because here lately, and I predicted this back in March and April, now we're starting to get a lot of criticism coming from Congress about how that program has been implemented, which, you know, I would say that it was a bad plan to start with. The biggest issue had to do with the fact that the people who designed the program had almost no knowledge or a very basic knowledge of how unemployment works. And so when you take that into consideration, and those type of individuals are basically making or putting together our plan, it's going to be a bad plan. We could have helped you out and told you some things to do differently on the front end that could have saved everybody a lot of trouble and made this a lot smoother.
You told me that last time. Did that not even get better throughout these last 9 months?
Well, it's one of those kind of things. You can't fix the barn door after the cows get out because it's already done.
The cows are gone. True.
And so, Yeah, it's out there. And so my biggest fear is in this next round of changes, they're going to, you know, make, you know, a brand new program and not even, you know, I mean, build on what we've already got. I mean, we've got, you know, tens of thousands of man hours in programming in this new system that we're currently using right now. And if they would just go in and tweak it some, you know, we can make this work. And I have been, you know, on the phone a lot and in a lot of Zoom conference calls with staff members up there and explain to them the things that were not put together right and things that need to change. And we'll just have to see if they actually take any of those suggestions and make it so.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Georgia's Labor Commissioner, Mark Butler. Well, let me ask you this. We know there was a backlog. We've had that conversation. Where are you all now in terms of all those folks from back in March and April and May, those claims? Were you all able to catch up with the backlog there?
Well, we actually don't have a current backlog when it comes to actually processing claims. The biggest, if you want to call it a backlog or workload right now, has to do with claims where, let's say that somebody filed for unemployment and they didn't report any income. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then they appealed us denying that. You know, the appeals process is fairly backed up due to the fact that there's only so many people that can do those. Or in cases where somebody reports that they were laid off, but yet their employer reports back, no, this person was fired for cause, or the employer reports back, no, this person was not laid off. They quit reporting to work. They basically abandoned their job. Those cases obviously are going to take longer because then there has to be an investigation, a fact finding, and both sides get to make their case because unemployment, especially regular unemployment, is well, one of those deals where the employer is the one that pays the tax on basically this insurance product, if you want to look at it that way. And so if they disagree with what the reason was put in to ask for unemployment, you know, they do get a say so on it because it's their rate that's affected by how many people get laid off. And, you know, obviously, you know, we look at both sides and we're a neutral party in that. And it's just like a miniature court case where you have a hearing officer who is kind of like a judge, mm-hmm. and you hear evidence from both sides. And then they make a determination based on case law, actual state and federal law, and also state and federal rules. So that person who does that, you know, has a fair amount of education and usually a lot of experience who is an appeals officer. Which that's one of the areas where we've concentrated the most on increasing our capacity. Because when back in February, before this started, we only had about 25 appeals officers, which was, you know, maybe a little bit low, but somewhat, you know, sufficient for the workload we had back then. But obviously, when you go from only having, say, a few thousand appeals a month to mm-hmm. 50,000 appeals, that's a different workload.
Let me ask you this, Commissioner, and I imagine someone listening may want to know the answer to this. If someone did stop going to work, or as you put it, abandon their job due to concerns through their lens, perhaps this employer was not practicing social distancing or implementing measures to protect its employees, so that employee said, you know what, I'm out. Could that work in their favor?
No, that's actually not an allowable reason.
Really?
The CARES Act did allow, no. Which is one of the reasons why I have argued that, you know, when Congress came up with the idea of providing, financial assistance to people, choosing the method of unemployment insurance was not the proper method. You take a look at what some other countries have done. They provided financial assistance through other means. But when you say, okay, we're just going to let people apply for unemployment, but we're still want you to apply the rules of unemployment to each one of these cases. In the case of COVID, how that works is in order for you to get unemployment other than the normal reasons, you either have to be somebody that has a documented medical reason that causes you to be a high risk, or you're over the age of 60, or you live with somebody of those two previous reasons I just gave you, or there is a lack of childcare. Those are the only reasons that are allowable under the COVID emergency situation.
Do you think that's fair? Do you think that's fair?
Well, it doesn't really matter kind of what I think. I have to apply what the law says.
Well, sure, but I'm curious in your opinion, though. I mean, if someone works...
Well, I mean, you also got to look at it in a different way, too, because, one person's opinion, what they think is safe, and somebody else's is going to be different. So now you're getting to a subjective reason. You know, remember, you've got all these, companies and people saying, we want to shut down. We don't want to go into work. But, my folks have had to go into work. They've had to be able to perform. Some things we can do from home, but a lot of things we can't. And so, our folks have been going to work every single day, and we've made, as best we can mm-hmm. accommodations, but even that has been somewhat difficult when you consider, the fact that, when you try to social distance here at the Department of Labor, but then you've also under pressure to add a whole lot more employees and you've only got so much space to have access to the tools that you need. And also when it comes to training, it's been very difficult. So,
have you had employees have you had employees, Commissioner, that have either quit or due to concerns about COVID? You mentioned those career centers may not be open to the public, but folks were still coming in. Have you experienced that with the department? And
yes. I mean, we're no different than anybody else. I mean, we've actually, we've had people that have either, maybe taken early retirement. We have had some people quit, and a lot of most of the quits have not been COVID related. They've been pressure. Related due to the fact that the strain. We've had a lot of IT, we've had several people over there that have decided that, that the strain and the pressure and the workload is too much. That's actually been a small percentage. When you take a look at all, overall, most of my employees have risen to the challenge. And obviously, like I told you, we also have had some people that have had to go home temporarily because of sickness. Mm-hmm. We've actually had a few individuals, or several individuals that have had to be hospitalized and have had actually a long recuperation. And some of those have not come back to work yet. Mm-hmm. And so we ask that everybody keep those in your prayers, too. So, I mean, like I said, people want to throw some criticism at me. That's fine. But, mm-hmm. these employees, they ought to be looked at, quite frankly, as heroes because, I could tell you 100 different stories of some of the sacrifices and things that people have done, and the type of, the hours they've worked and things mm-hmm. and their own personal tragedies they've had to work through during this time. I've just been blown away, by the employees that I have here.
No, you're absolutely right. There've been so many folks who have continued to work, whether they've been healthcare workers or essential workers or first responders. So, I don't think anyone should dispute that. All the more reason why you know the importance of employers making sure that if they are going to be open, although you can't mandate that, if they are going to be open and require their employees to come in, that they should take those measures in place to ensure the safety of their employees.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. You've got to take care of your employees, no matter if it's COVID or anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've ran businesses of one type or another all my life, and the one thing is, I mean, your company is your employees, mm-hmm. and if you don't take care of your employees are not going to take care of your company. And so, anybody that mistreats an employee is not doing right by their even by what they're trying to do.
Let's try to end our conversation on a happy note here. Tell our listeners what areas or industries are hiring and looking for folks.
Gosh, right now, it seems like it's just about across the board. The only areas where we're not seeing like a tremendous jump are going to be the ones that are still somewhat affected by COVID. And you're talking about hospitality, mm-hmm. Food and drinking places. But, a lot of those are currently hiring right now. We're seeing a record number of job listings on Employ Georgia. As of the last time I checked, we have over 160,000 active job listings. And those are not just, one job listing, for one person. A lot of those job listings are for multiple people for that just one job listing. And, you know, it's, you know, obviously in a lot of retail trade, specialty trade, there's also a lot of, there was a story the other day saying that most of all the hiring right now is temporary jobs. And that's not what we're seeing by the job listings that we're having right now. There's a lot of permanent job listings right now. And one of the neat things that we're seeing, which is really good for our workers here in Georgia, is because of the fact that we do have a shortage of available workers, it is pushing pay up. I've talked to a lot of employers around the state on a constant basis, and we're seeing a lot of them pushing their, especially the hourly employers, are starting to push their hourly wages up. I talked to a guy the other day that I was trying to refer somebody to. It was a lady who's been working during the entire time of the pandemic, but she actually works for one of those employers who's not been doing a very good job as far as pay. And she's a real hard worker. And so I called a guy that I know that has a company close by, and he normally pays about $15 an hour. But when I called him up, he informed me they had actually pushed their pay up to about $16.50 to $17 an hour. And the reason was because of COVID. COVID has actually had to make them be more competitive with their pay, which actually we've actually experienced that also here at the Department of Labor.
Now, what's that website again for folks so they can?
Employ Georgia.
Okay. And finally, Commissioner, as you know, nearly every state is experiencing an increase in new COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations. But the concerns are this might lead to more unemployment benefit claims. But if we are experiencing yet another wave, what might this do to the Georgia Department of Labor? Will you all have the resources to handle potentially another increase in unemployment claims?
Well, obviously, since we've been through this once, you know, that first wave was the first time that any state had experienced anything like that. You know, there's a lot of lessons learned when you go through something the very first time. I think, quite frankly, we're better prepared to handle it in the future, mainly. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of the new things that we've added, a lot of new tools that we've added that we didn't have the first go around because it just didn't have time to implement. When you're talking about, you know, they basically gave us a couple of weeks to be prepared, and there's no way you can get a lot of that stuff online in a couple of weeks. You know, most of the things that we've had to do in normal times would have taken you, you know, 6 to 12 months to put together. Mm-hmm. And we were asked to do it in basically, you know, 4 weeks. And so we have a lot more capacity now all the way around. And so I think, you know, if we had to go through another one of those, like we had to experience back during the March and April, we're definitely in a better position now than we were then, just because, you know, we're more experienced and know what to look for. I mean, you had no way of knowing what you were going to run into back then.
Well, another election year for you will be starting soon. You plan to try to stay in office?
You know, that's kind of one of those things. I don't know how other people who are in elected office looked at it. You look at it every time, just kind of based on your own your personal surroundings. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it you want to do? I mean, I'm not one of those kind of people that looks at elected office as one of those things where I just have to do it. It's one of those things, you know, if you run, you got to run again. I'm not saying one way or the other right now, because that's 2 years into the future. And just kind of see where everything's at. And, you know, if I think that I can still bring something to the table, if there's still a challenge, then we'll look at it. But, you know, you never know. There may be other things out there that I may want to take a look at or not. Mm-hmm. You have to weigh all those factors. At least you should weigh all those factors if you're in elected office. Don't just do it just to be doing it. You need to do it based upon, you know, just like anybody else. Like if you've been at a certain job for a long time, mm-hmm. you kind of get to a place where you have to sit back and you reevaluate that. The difference is here in elective office, you know, you're kind of forced to do that every so often, like maybe every 2 years or every 4 years, to take that look back and evaluate where you've been, where you want to go. And actually, it's kind of it's kind of a neat thing. I think everybody ought to do that every so often. Take a look at where you're at in your professional life, because at this stage in my life and at my age, it's not really about money or anything like that anymore. It's about, you know, are you still doing things that are giving back to you and giving back to somebody else? Is it still a challenge to you? Is it still, you know, are you still enjoying what you do? Do you look forward to going into work? And I tell people all the time, if you hate going into work, you need to find you something else different to do. Quit looking at the money, quit looking at the, you know, the prestige or things like that. You've got to look at it from your own mental health and your own perspective. And it's no different in political office. I think everybody should take a look at that. If you still enjoy it, then you should keep doing it. If you don't, then, you know, do something else.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not that simple, but I definitely have heard that before. Georgia Labor Commissioner.
I think it's that simple. I mean,
for some folks, you know what? They may have a family or, you know, I mean, you know, sometimes you got to look.
I've got one of those too.
Well, I mean, come on now, Commissioner. Yeah. Yeah, you do. But sometimes, look, you know what I'm talking about. Don't.
I just hope the world of politics gets a little bit more. I don't know what the proper term, a little bit nicer in the next couple of years. I'm kind of tired of all the, you know, the hatred and, you know, either my way or
nastiness.
Yeah. You know, when I got into politics,
well,
yeah, when I first got into politics, you know, you could disagree with somebody and not have to hate them, you know? And I would really like for not just here in Georgia, but everywhere to get back to that. You know, let's start having discussions. And it's not a football game where you have to beat somebody 40-0. You know, I mean, it's, you know, politics is the art of negotiation. And right now, I just don't see a lot of that going on.
I think a lot of people would agree with you. Georgia Labor Commissioner Mark Butler, as always, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And again, our condolences on the loss of your employees there due to COVID-19. We're sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Georgia's top election officials have come under intense scrutiny and pressure to ensure the integrity of our election results. Accusations and criticism ranging from the Trump campaign to Georgia's U.S. Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, albeit there's been no evidence which proves any of the claims. Still, that hasn't stopped harassment and even threats of violence towards Georgia's election officials. Now, Gabriel Sterling is a voting system official in the Secretary of State's office. Well, he let loose during a press conference yesterday.
This is elections. This is the backbone of democracy. And all of you who have not said a damn word are complicit in this. It's too much. Yes, fight for every legal vote. Go through your due process. Death threats, physical threats, intimidation. It's too much.
Meanwhile, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger claims investigations are warranted regarding some specific voter groups. Now, ahead of yesterday's 5th Congressional District runoff, Raffensperger stated these were, quote, credible allegations.
As we move to the December 1st election, which is tomorrow, and the January 5th federal runoffs, we have to remain vigilant. That is why I'm announcing an investigation into third-party groups working to register people in other states to vote here in Georgia. We have opened an investigation into a group called America Votes, who is sending absentee ballot applications to people at addresses where they have not lived since 1994. Vote Forward, who attempted to register a dead Alabama voter, a woman to vote here in Georgia. The New Georgia Project, who sent voter registration applications to New York City. And Operation New Voter Registration Georgia, who is telling college students in Georgia that they can change their residency to Georgia and then change it back after the election. Let me be very clear again. Voting in Georgia when you are not a resident of Georgia is a felony.
Well, now we turn to one of these four groups to hear their response to these allegations. Joining me now is Nse Ufot. She's the chief executive officer for the New Georgia Project. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
How long have you been with the New Georgia Project?
Since 2014. New Georgia Project was founded by Leader Abrams in 2013. And when they switched its focus to large-scale voter registration efforts, I came on as the executive director and now CEO.
And we should note you're talking about Stacey Abrams.
I am.
For clarity, the New Georgia Project, is it part of Fair Fight and all that, or is this totally different?
The New Georgia Project is a completely separate entity. It precedes Fair Fight. It precedes Leader Abrams' run for governor. So since 2014, we've helped register nearly 500,000 Georgians to vote in all 159 of Georgia's counties. And so that work continues today.
Have you all ever, prior to this election season, have you all ever been under investigation or had to deal with any allegations or claims of malicious or suspicious or even straight up voter fraudulent activity as it relates to registering people?
I live in Georgia, of course. Of course. We have, since this inception, listen, the first year the New Georgia Project launched its voter registration efforts, we sought to register. We registered 86,419 Georgians to vote. By the voter registration deadline, only 46,000 of the folks that we registered showed up on the voter rolls. So there were 40,000 Georgians that we had registered to vote who were missing. And when we asked the Secretary of State and many of the county boards of elections what happened to those 40,000 folks, they replied with a retaliatory investigation. So this is par for the course.
What year was that?
2014.
Did you ever get a response?
Oh, yeah, we did get a response by about 2016. They had dropped the investigation and told us that, that the New Georgia Project was not subject to the investigation. And then they turned their attention to the college students and the young canvassers and volunteers who worked with us to help register people to vote. And so those are still pending. This is definitely par for the course.
What happened to the 40,000 folks that you all and through the Secretary of State's office admit they were dropped or removed from the rolls? Or did they ever even make the rolls?
Yes, they did. About 25,000 of them made it onto the voter rolls up to 9 months after the election in which we registered them for. We sued in state court and we lost, unfortunately, and because we were told that there's no law in Georgia that requires the Secretary of State or the counties for that matter to register voters by a particular deadline. So despite the fact that we had registered them by the voter registration deadline, the county and the state didn't have to process their forms, and those folks started showing up on the rolls 9 months after we registered them.
So the issue, through your lens, based on what the Secretary of State's office told you, was missing a deadline, nothing else in terms of fraudulent activity or people using fake addresses or not even living in Georgia, nothing like that, just that the deadline was missed for registration. Is that correct?
We did not miss the deadline for registration. The issue is that in a rapidly growing Georgia, where millions of people have moved into the state over the past decade, many of them people of color, that the electorate is changing. Mm-hmm. And we have secretaries of state, consecutive now, and some county board of elections officials who have not lived up to the people's expectations of what it means to be the chief elections officer for the state of Georgia. That's what the issue is that people are registering to vote and that there are deficiencies in Georgia's elections infrastructure that has been exposed by the scope, the scale, the breadth of the voter registration and civic engagement work that groups like the New Georgia Project are doing.
Take our listeners through a typical initiative that you all might go through to register someone to vote. Take us through that process.
Yeah. So I'd like to say that there isn't anything typical about the way that we do voter reg. I will say that it is the sort of the best practices from community organizing, right? Mm-hmm. So we meet people where they are. We register folks in high schools, partnering with guidance counselors, principals, PTAs, et cetera. Welcome to adulthood. You're 18, now register to vote. We leverage a lot of culture, right? So gaming and technology. On National Voter Registration Day, we had a live stream called Twitch the Vote. Twitch is a form, it's like YouTube for mm-hmm. gamers. We registered nearly 9,000 folks in one day based off of our Twitch the Vote live stream. High schools, college campuses, county fairs, music festivals, that we have offices in 7 cities around the state of Georgia. There's nowhere where we won't go to register people to vote.
And when you say register, give them the application, you take their information and you put it, what's that process like?
Yeah, so we, the way that we train our canvassers and organizers is that you have twice as many ears as you do mouths. And so often it is the result of a conversation. What we do, we do what we call issue identification. So when we're out in public, in front of a grocery store, asking people what are the issues that they care about. And then we work to connect the act of voting to those issues that they care about in that initial conversation. And so we hand people a blank voter registration form and allow them to fill it out. Given the fact how much we leverage and use technology, it might come as a shock to some of your listeners that we register people on blank paper forms. But again, we also very much are aware of the context and the environment in which we do this work. Mm-hmm. So the ability to scan it into the cloud, the ability to have backup paper copies. We also get voters to sign a consent form that they consent, like, yes, I want to register with the New Georgia Project today. And so there are a number of redundancies and protections that are built into our program to ensure that, one, the people who registered to vote actually get registered, and two, that in the likelihood that we get accused of some sort of fraud, mm-hmm. that we have our receipts.
Do you all ask them to declare a particular party? Is that an option for them?
It's not even an option, no.
So you're just getting their information, and then you all are able to submit it to the Secretary of State's office? Just want to be clear for our listeners so they understand the process here.
Yeah, we submit it, we more than likely submit it to the county that the person is registered to vote.
What information or documentation are you all requiring to make sure that they are eligible to vote, not only in their county but in their state? Or you all just don't concern yourselves with that? You get their information and then you proceed with what you just told me.
It's the job of the County Board of Elections officials and the job of the Secretary of State to verify people's eligibility. We're community organizers, and so we go out and we ask people if they're eligible to vote. And if they say yes, then we're registering them. And again, it is the job of the county mm-hmm. to say whether or not a person is ineligible or not and why.
What's the length of time in between when you all submit that to the counties, and then if you get information back saying, hey, we have no record of this person, or the address didn't match, or whatever, how long does that take? And then what do you all do if you get that information back like that?
So your listeners should first know that there are 159 counties in Georgia, which means that there are 159 kings and queens of elections. And so they fall all along the spectrum in terms of timeline. Mm-hmm. There are some counties that are on it. They're fantastic, right? And that between the receipt of application and a person getting notice that they've made it onto the voter rolls could be, you know, 2 weeks, mm-hmm. 30 days at the max. And then there are counties that take forever. And so one, I think it's important to know that. Two, that information doesn't come back to us directly. If there are issues with a registrant's application, that information goes to the registrant at the address that they use to register to vote.
If you're just joining us, the voice you hear is Nse Umfant. She's the chief executive officer of the New Georgia Project. And we're talking about not only the organization's voter registration process, but also Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger says that they are one of four voter registration groups that are being investigated. When you heard Secretary Raffensperger mention your organization just the other day, what did you make of that?
I was like, oh, they're sad. That's so sad. I mean, there's zero evidence that we are registering voters in New York City or anywhere outside of Georgia. When I think about how difficult it is to get to that 500,000 mark of registering Georgians, like the idea that we have the interest, the desire, and quite frankly, the resources to register anybody but Georgians is ridiculous. And then my second thought was, this is how disinformation is really harmful. And this is like, and so it, this is how disinformation and misinformation campaigns attack our democracy, attack our elections infrastructure, and make people lose credibility. This is Republican fan fiction.
Have you all ever mailed voter registration applications to anyone out of state?
No, we have not. So what, as our... We still haven't been contacted by the Secretary of State or their investigators. So let me start with that. Mm-hmm. And so this is nothing more than a press conference. And again, an attempt to traffic in disinformation and spread Republican fan fiction. What we think has happened is we have a postcard program where Americans in other states can volunteer to request postcards from the New Georgia Project and some of our allies. And they take the postcards and they can request them in batches of 10, 25, 50. Mm-hmm. And they will write handwritten notes to Georgians who are not registered to vote, Georgians who have been purged from Georgia's voter rolls, or Georgians who are registered and need a reminder that an election is around the corner. And so these volunteers say, hey, sign me up. I live in New Jersey. I live in New York. I live in California. I live in Illinois. And I want to give me a batch of 25 postcards so that I could send them out to Georgia voters. And so what it looks like is that a volunteer in New York requested a batch of postcards. They were delivered improperly to the wrong recipient. The wrong recipient got them and went to Twitter to say, New Georgia Project sent me a bunch of postcards. They're trying to get me to register to vote. And then the Secretary of State looked at that tweet and launched an investigation into our work.
So these were just folks who were, could be, I guess you could call them ambassadors or volunteers wanting to help people, remind people to either register to vote or whatever you have on a postcard. You were not sending any applications to people outside of Georgia.
Absolutely not. It's in our name. The name of the organization is the New Georgia Project. Again, to date, we've helped nearly 500,000 Georgians of color and young Georgians, new Americans, register to vote in all 159 of Georgia's counties. That is a massive undertaking alone. And our goal is to get eligible but unregistered Georgians registered to vote.
Have you or anyone from your organization had a conversation with Brad Raffensperger or anyone from the Secretary of State's office? ever about allegations?
We are in regular communication with the Secretary of State's office through ourselves as advocates, but also through our attorneys. We're a voting rights organization, and we're a highly effective voting rights organization. And so as a part of, our due diligence, as a part of, normalizing this kind of work, we have regular communications with the folks in the Secretary of Arts, which also makes the idea that this investigation has been launched and no one from our team has been contacted. It makes it that much more egregious. It highlights the fact of how little credibility this little investigation has.
What do you make of even right now with allegations? And as I mentioned earlier, in every news outlet, every credible news outlet has noted these allegations are baseless and have no findings, no evidence from the Trump campaign to Senators Loeffler and Perdue that Georgia's elections operations are somehow filled with nefarious or suspicious or fraudulent activity. And this is being levied by Republicans against a Republican Secretary of State. What do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, I don't enjoy watching bullying. It's kind of cringy. It's uncomfortable to watch. I'm not a person that runs to see a fight. And so as I see the attacks on our Secretary of State and our elections workers by members of their own party, it's sad, it's a distraction. And again, I also think that that is why it has led to them trying to pick on, bully, and intimidate voting rights organizations because they need to find someone else to pick on.
And since Secretary of State Raffensperger has made the announcement that he's investigating you all and three other groups, have you had folks calling or inquiring about the integrity of the organization?
No, we have not. We have receipts. We do this and we do it well. To think that we would be allowed to do this work for almost 7 years in Georgia under Secretary of State Brian Kemp at the time, and now Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, be allowed to continue to do this work again in the Deep South if we didn't know what we were doing, if we weren't highly effective, if we weren't legitimately expanding the electorate and bringing hundreds of thousands of new voters into our democracy, we would have been shut down. They don't have any credibility. These are partisan attacks. We will continue to register young people to vote, register new Americans to vote, new Georgians to vote. We'll continue to have a bold and aggressive research agenda at the core of our work, figuring out the best ways to have conversations with people about voting. We'll continue to have the dopest, flyest, most fun, livest Election Day parties, Election Day activations, cool, innovative ways to move people to the polls, and they will deal.
Nse Ufot is the chief executive officer of the New Georgia Project, and we've been talking about Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger's. They are one of four organizations being investigated. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.